The Teaching Saints Virtual Summit was an incredible success. We had thousands of individuals tune in from around the world to hear from people like Brad Wilcox, Hank Smith, Casey Griffiths, Marie Eckersley, Jason Hewlett, Jeff Burke, and more as they taught us about how to better stimulate classroom discussion, create effective classroom environments, best practices with object lessons, and so much more. If you missed the summit, be sure to visit leadinglds.org/teach to watch the three most viewed sessions from the online conference. It will not only change you, but it will change those you teach. Check out the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit today. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Hello, this is Kurt Frankum, your host of the Leading LDS podcast. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but on Twitter, those of you that are, tweet, there is actually something called the Twitter stake. And it's sort of just out of fun that there's different Twitter handles that reflect different callings of awards. So there's a LDS stake president, LDS elders quorum president, relief society president, primary president, and also an LDS bishop. And LDS bishop, who is actually Ross Truella, has been tweeting for quite a few years now. He is a real bishop, has been serving for 9 years now. 9 years. And I've always enjoyed his perspective and tweets. He's a good follow on Twitter, if that's your thing. And so he actually lives in the UK, and I found out that he was coming to Utah. His wife is from Utah, so they come here from time to time. And we recorded this right after the April 2018 General Conference. And he was in town. We met up and recorded an interview, and it turned out fantastic. He shares with us his five leadership principles that he lives by and leads by, which are fantastic. Talks about the church in the UK and how it's growing and developing in his part of the country. And then we have an interesting discussion about diverse opinions when it comes to the church and in our ward meetings and how that can help or hurt us and in our progress towards the same goal of becoming more like our Savior, Jesus Christ. And so I think you will definitely enjoy this. So here's my interview with the LDS Bishop on Twitter, Ross Truella. Today, I'm sitting down with somebody all the way from the other side of the globe, but he's in person now.
Hello.
Ross Truella. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Now, you are a bishop in the, what's the name of your ward?
It's the Redruth Ward, which is in the Plymouth, England stake.
Nice. So in the UK.
In the UK, yeah.
Nice. And born and raised in the UK?
Yes, I am Cornish. I'm far southwest of the UK. Lived there most of my life.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Apart from, I was in Utah for a little while.
Nice.
Which is where I joined the church, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. And we're going to definitely get into that story. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people may not recognize your voice, but they would definitely recognize your Twitter handle as you are LDS Bishop on Twitter.
I am indeed, yes.
Nice. Now, and there's some type of, they call it like the Twitter stake on Twitter. And there's, you're the bishop, and there's a stake president. There's Sunday school president, the stake clerk's another good follow there.
Yeah.
But did that happen organically from what you know?
As far as I know, it did. I mean, I suppose about 6 years ago, I decided I had a few funny things to say about the experience of being a bishop. So I thought I'd create a Twitter account anonymously, which I did, and I don't know if I was the first LDS whatever calling on Twitter, but there were certainly a few others that came along and would tweet their experiences as well, but I just thought it would be a laugh, basically.
Yeah, and you were anonymous for quite some time.
I was anonymous for a good few years, yes.
Yeah. Nice. And the point being that you weren't, obviously talking about bishop things, not that you were divulging certain things, but you didn't want to necessarily doubt yourself.
Yeah, I was always very careful. I would never break any confidences. I would never talk about ward members by name or anything like that. But I just wanted to be anonymous because, I don't like publicity, to be honest.
Yeah.
And just thought it was, something that people might be interested in without needing to know that I was tweeting as the bishop of a particular ward in a particular area.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember when I first came across you on Twitter, I was serving as a bishop at the same time. And I just sort of appreciated the, I don't know if I'd say it was snark, but just the funny things of serving as a leader that you pointed out.
A bit of dry sarcasm.
Yeah. That's popular in the UK,
yes,
right?
Yeah. My default mode. But it's... I think everybody in most callings in the church have to deal with awkward situations and sometimes nonsense situations that is just funny to talk about sometimes. You know, every missionary I've ever spoken to has always had a crazy companion, and every bishop I've ever spoken to has had to deal with similar experiences to me, which you'd have to deal with awkward things that go on, especially with regards to church culture and such.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was always very conscious. I didn't want to mock any aspects of the religion itself, but culture around it and the silly things that might go on.
Yeah, there's really nothing funny about the doctrine of the church, but there's a whole lot of funny about the culture of the church.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right? So tell us the story. When did you decide not to be anonymous anymore? How did that come
about? So, well, it's interesting. A few years ago, I had a text message in December from my stake president saying, hey, can myself and one of my counselors meet with you tomorrow? And I went, sure, yeah, what's that about? And he went, you'll find out tomorrow. And I thought, great, I'm being released. You know, this is it. And he turns up and says, I've been looking a bit at social media and, you know, I got a LinkedIn profile and I don't really use Facebook and I've never really used Twitter, but I came across this Twitter account the other day called LDS Bishop. And I thought, well, you know, he's going to try and draw this out. I said, yeah, that's me.
Nice.
And he said, well, there were some things in there that, you know, it's funny and we like it. There's just a couple of tweets out of the 600 tweets I had at the time that, you know, maybe not be becoming a bishop. So just be careful with what you tweet in the future. And I went, oh, all right, fair enough.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure how he found out, but as far as I'm aware, he was contacted by an Area 70 who could very well have been contacted by somebody else just saying, are you aware of this guy?
Yeah. So I'm sure a member of the Quorum of the Twelve was the first one to find it, and it just worked its way down.
I'm sure, yes. You know.
That's great. That's great. So how long have you served as bishop?
I have served just over 9 years.
9 years?
9 years as the bishop.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, you must be doing a fantastic job.
That I'm a very slow learner, I think.
Nice. And so is that typical for your stake or that just to have longer bishops at the area? Or
it doesn't seem to be. Well, obviously, something that's always pointed out to me when I complain about it, that there are no term limits for bishops.
Right,
I know, realize it's typical that bishops serve 4 or 5 years and then they're released, but there are no term limits for bishops. They can serve for as long as it's required.
Yeah.
But I think I'm the longest serving bishop in the stake, and I think I'm the longest serving bishop that the ward has ever had in one go. Uh-huh. There are other guys in the ward that have served a couple of terms of bishop, but they've kind of split 2 years of five. So
yeah.
If I can make it to 10 years, I'm done.
Yeah. And there's no rumbling of your release coming, or you just, you'll take it when it comes.
I'll take it when it comes. I've stopped, you know, whining about it. You know, to be honest, about when I hit about year four, I thought, well, I'm coming towards the end of this now. And, you know, I would say I'm pretty ready for release at that time.
Uh-huh.
But now I'm on year nine, I'm actually terrified of being released.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, it's what I know. It's, you know, the Stockholm syndrome of church callings is I've been in it for quite a while. I genuinely still enjoy serving as the bishop.
Yeah.
You know, you have to deal with a lot of awkward situations and difficulties in the calling, but I enjoy serving. I enjoy the work and I enjoy interacting with the members of my ward and being part of it. So I just have this worry that one day I'll just turn up to church one day and the stake president will be there and say, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Goodbye. You know.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I mean, in my opinion, one of the best callings in the church. You know, I loved my time as bishop. And yeah, there's those parts of the calling that are just like overwhelming, you know, some sleepless nights. But really, I mean, there's some fantastic parts about it.
I think ultimately it's where the rubber meets the road of church callings. Yeah. It's really is that's where the work is done in the church, is in wards. And the bishop is the head of that ward. And that's really the real work of the church takes place there, and everything else is either encouraging that work if you have a calling higher up the priesthood leadership chain, or so being a part of that is very enjoyable to me.
Yeah. I was in a meeting with Elder Renland, not to name drop or anything, but when I was bishop, you know, every few years we had the opportunity to meet with the apostle, and he was quoting somebody, I don't remember who, but he used the term that the church hinges on the calling of bishop. I mean, that is, you know, you say that where the rubber meets the road, that is so much happens there, and so much, it's a make or break calling, right? People can either really enjoy their experience because they're bishop, or it can be a negative one too.
So. It can be. I mean, there's plenty of negatives about it, because I think if you're not very, very careful about how you use your time and delegate certain areas of responsibility, you can burn yourself out incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
And it took me quite a while to learn to let go of certain aspects of administering the ward to make sure I was better at ministering to the members and doing the things that only a bishop in a ward can do,
yeah,
rather than, you know, trying to do everything.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to step back and you have an interesting background and you're a convert to the church, but maybe mm-hmm. just give us an update. What's how would you talk about the church in your part of the world, the status, the growth, what's it like being a Mormon in your area?
Well, the church is well established in the UK. You know, obviously, the first converts in the church are in the United Kingdom,
yeah,
and they came over here. But, you know, in my area, it's quite large geographically, and there aren't many members of the church. In terms of active membership in my ward, in a sacrament meeting, we get 60 to 70 on a Sunday. Stake-wide, which is all of Devon and Cornwall in the United Kingdom, for those of you that know it, there are 8 units and probably 600-700 active members of the church. But in my ward, it's interesting. So in the winter, it's quiet, 60 to 70 members. And then in the summertime, I live near the beach and it's a big tourist area. So I get 150, 160
oh, wow.
plus. I can't quite get them all in the building in the summer.
Wow.
So I become the bishop to a bunch of people I've never met every year and get phone calls to visit them in the hospital when they've hurt themselves surfing or something. And,
interesting. Yeah. So they're not there just for the weekend. I mean, they have a cabin or something that they go to.
Camping or something. Yeah. It's, you know, they get a lot of people on a Sunday come from the campsite and, you know,
oh, wow.
rush to the bathrooms in the church to do their hair and
yeah.
smut themselves up. And
that's cool. How long does it take to get to the temple?
To the temple, our closest temple is the London Temple, which takes about, from where I live, about 5 hours to drive, possibly longer. It depends on the time of year.
Wow. So do you organize, is there a quarterly temple trip you do, or how does that, as a ward? Or?
Yeah, we have very dedicated temple attendants in our ward, actually. Mm. So we organize regular temple visits where we would hire a little bus or something to take people to the temple. And then we have other members that just, you know, have a car and they're going up for a couple of days and they say, I have a couple of seats free, who wants to go? And
yeah.
people pop up there. So actually, I think our stake has better temple attendance than stakes that are closer to the temple.
Oh, interesting.
People just seem very dedicated about that work.
Yeah. And so do you have like a specific budget, a temple budget to rent buses and things to go, or how does that work?
No, people sacrifice their own money to provide that. Obviously, if there are members who can't afford it, we find means of helping them out and paying. So anyone that wants to go to the temple can go. And
right.
I know financially, there's no reason why people can't go to the temple because, you know, we'd make it work.
Yeah.
But it is generally quite a sacrifice to go to the temple. It's not something you could do of a Friday evening, for example. You're going to travel that amount of time. You're going to have to go for a few days. So you have to take time off work and
yeah.
you know, make sure the kids are looked after if you've got young kids at home. And so it is more of a sacrifice to get to the temple than other areas of the world.
And does the temple have some type of dormitories that
you
stay in?
Yeah, there's an accommodation temple at accommodation center at the temple. So I don't know, it's very similar, I'm told, to if you've ever stayed in student housing at BYU. It's basically like that. But there's one fancy room which has a chandelier in it, which they use for the honeymoon suite getting married. And it's very affordable as well. Obviously, you know, the temple is outside of London, but accommodation in the area is generally quite expensive. But you can stay night at the temple for £15 and $20. You know, it's
interesting. That's great. So let's go back to and talk about your history a little bit. You're a convert to the church.
I am.
How did take us back to the beginning? When did the first contact be made?
The first contact with a church member that I was aware of was actually the lady who I became engaged to. So a bunch of, I think, very unique circumstances meant that after I graduated, I ended up in Utah, engaged to a Mormon girl that lived here, and I was you know, early 20s, 20 years
old. So you graduated in college in the UK?
In the UK, and I ended up in Utah. Just
randomly, or what?
Okay, well, I might be told off for telling this story, but okay, so
whatever
I struck up a online relationship with somebody.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't a romantic relationship at all, just a friendship on a forum that we were both mutually members of.
Gotcha.
And
that was not your wife.
And that was not my wife. She is now. But Laurie said, you know, hey, you know, if you're ever in the area, you know, just, you know, let me know, knowing that someone would never travel that distance.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. I just came.
Nice.
And turned up, and we got engaged quite quickly. And so obviously she was a member of the church and didn't want to push the church thing on me, but yeah. her mother said it would be a very good idea to have Ross have the missionary lessons, just so he is aware of what is expected of his wife when they get married. And I thought, well, you know, you want to impress your future mother-in-law. So I decided, you know, I'll humor her and have the lessons and then be gone. And, you know, if Laurie wants to keep going to church when we're married, that's fine by me. But, you know, wasn't particularly religious.
Yeah. So no
up.
Religious background at this point.
Not, well, you know, I was christened in the Church of England.
Okay.
And never
that's
went.
Very typical.
And
right.
And I went to a Catholic primary school between the ages of 5 and 11 and went to mass every week and hated it. Uh-huh. So I just thought, you know, that's not for me. A religious life is not for me.
Yeah. But and at that point, did you even have a belief in God or some of those basic tenets?
I suppose on a very, very low level, I kind of had a feeling that there was maybe something else beyond this life, some other divine being. But, you know, I never really took it seriously, looked into it, studied it, never read the Bible. You know, I had a very primary level for my schooling when I was younger of, you know, this is God and these are the church stories and, you know, this is what Jesus did and that was about it.
Yeah.
But I never developed what I would define as a firm belief in it, but there was always in the back of my mind that there might be something.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, I had the missionary discussions, but it was actually conversations with my future in-laws that made me think about it more because they could talk to me on a human level. The missionaries were great and they would teach me the doctrines of the church, but I couldn't identify with the missionaries, but I got on well with my future extended family and they would answer the questions I had and they could, you know, guide me through the unique aspects of Utah Mormon culture, which was very alien to me. You know, they live just outside of Salt Lake in a slightly rural ward. So I had nothing in common with anybody in the ward I was going to. I don't think they had a convert baptism for forever. They didn't have a ward mission leader. They didn't have any gospel principles, teachers or anything. Uh-huh. So we should have better call some of them.
Yeah.
That was just for me. Huh. And so I investigated for a couple of months and really gave it some thought. And because, I think it's because I was quite far outside of my comfort zone. My comfort zone was miles away, 5,000 miles away. You know,
yeah.
I think I was more teachable. I was open to new ideas and new things. And I've always been a very quiet, shy person, so interacting with others was always difficult for me, especially when I was younger. And so because I was out of my comfort zone, it allowed me to question my beliefs more. And when I saw how other people lived their religion and I looked at the doctrines of the church more and I read the Book of Mormon, just sparked something in me, and I thought, well, I wanted some of that. And actually, to be honest with you, even when I was baptized, I was thinking, well, you know I might not be for me long term, but I'll do it now. And it wasn't actually until we moved back to the UK when we got married and I started serving on our little ward that I'm now the bishop of that really kind of stoked the fires of my testimony and made me really, I had significant spiritual experiences, which I can't even begin to articulate, to be honest, that made me realize it was all true.
Yeah. So in the early, you know, when you started investigating with the missionaries, it started as you were just appeasing that your in-laws and
yeah, you just want to, you know,
please them.
Put in a few token efforts to make me realize, you know, I'm not a bad guy.
Yeah. And then it was, it sounded like it became intriguing and interesting. You're asking questions.
Yes, I had questions.
But there wasn't yet this huge spiritual, like, impression.
I can't ever recall a certain time exactly that I went, yes, this is definitely true. I did have an interesting experience on the day of my baptism. And I prayed, you know, am I doing the right thing? And that was the only time in my life I've had an audible answer to a prayer. I just heard yes. Now, whether that was a TV in another room and it just so happened to be, I don't care. It was an answer to the prayer and I took it.
Yeah.
And I've gone from then on.
Wow.
But I've never had a firm, audible answer to a prayer like that before.
Yeah.
And so I ran with it.
Yeah. And did you get baptized before your marriage or after?
Yes, I got baptized about 6 months before we got married.
Oh, nice. And then did you both have plans to return to the UK after marriage or what took
we
you back
did,
there?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, I lived here with my future in-laws for a while. I worked here for a little while. And we got engaged very, very quickly, but we decided we wanted to take about a year before we got married. Mm. I've always had good advice that it's good to see people in all four seasons before you make that final commitment.
Sage advice.
Which is, I think for me at least, and we were both very young, you know, Laurie was only 19 years old. I was only 20 and that was young, you know, getting married at 21, I thought would be crazy. And it could very well have been if it wasn't various aspects of immigration in both our respective countries, we might have taken even longer. Mm. But to be able to move to the UK, we had to be married. It's the easiest way to do it. And but you know, we were so intensely in love, that was an easy choice, to be honest.
That's great.
And we've been married for 15 years now.
Yeah.
15 years this July, we'll be married.
Nice. And nine of those have been as the bishop.
Nine of those have been as the bishop. My poor wife has really never sat next to me in a sacrament.
Yeah. So you talk about when you returned to the UK and jumped into the ward and were serving there. Was there a specific type of service that really had those spiritual impressions on you, or how would you articulate that?
Well, after a few months in the ward, I was called to serve as the ward executive secretary, which means you interact with the bishopric a lot. So I was in bishopric meetings, I was in ward council meetings, and I just enjoyed the work. I enjoyed working, for example, in a ward council, which talks about how to help people. And I enjoyed getting to know members of the ward and just doing that. And I think when we are serving in a Christ-like manner, that actually boosts my testimony more than probably the person you're serving. It feels good. It's an enjoyable experience. You feel as if you are contributing something. And when you're doing that, it firms up a testimony.
Nice. And then, so this was, how long after your baptism did you move back to the UK?
So I baptized in December of 2002, and then we moved back to the UK in July 2003, which is when we got married. Hmm. So I was called as the ward exec sec a few months after that.
Okay, so you jumped right into this.
Jumped right into it. I was, you know, I'd been an elder for a matter of months. You know, I had certain administrative skills that they felt were required. And so I served as the executive secretary for a while. And then in was December of 2004, I was called as a counselor on the bishopric. And they didn't actually release me as the ward exec sec for a couple of years after that.
Oh, nice. So you did both.
I had those two things going for a while.
Wow. And was that was that a surprising call, or what do you remember of that?
Yes, it was. It was actually at the time, because obviously I was part of bishopric meetings and me being called to the bishopric was never discussed. In fact, it was discussed, I believe, to put me off the scent, calling me as the elders quorum president, because the ward was in need of an elders quorum president at the time.
So they did call you that, or that was
they
just
didn't. That was just a ruse.
Oh, I see.
And so I came to church one Sunday and a member of the stake presidency was there and said, can I see you in a minute? I thought, well, that's fine. I'm going to be called as the elders quorum president. Fine by me. I've been preparing myself for it for a couple of weeks since it was discussed in the meeting. But no, he called me as a counselor in the bishopric, which really surprised me, because I was only, 23 at the time. And I thought that was...
So you've only been a member a couple of years now?
A couple of years.
Had you gone to the temple at this point?
I had, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you kind of jumped through those hoops as
yes, typically... in terms of those requirements, you know, it was fine. I just had to be ordained a high priest to serve as in the bishopric. But it did come as a surprise. I just thought that, you know, because there were plenty of other men in the ward that could have served in that calling, so I didn't quite understand why they chose me. But
interesting.
Yeah. You know.
And then how long did you serve in the bishopric? I assume you were the next bishop after this.
I was the next bishop, yeah. Okay. So I had a fantastic bishop, Mike Beckerleg, who I was his counselor, second counselor for a couple of years, and his first counselor for a couple of years. And then he was released. And I suppose, you know, then I was called as the bishop in, it was December 2008.
Wow. And what do you remember of that that call coming to you?
Well, I had because obviously I've heard stories before when you get a phone call in the week saying, can you meet the stake president? It's only ever going to be one of a few things. And so I had a phone call, I think it was a Wednesday night, about 8:30 in the evening, from the stake executive secretary. And he asked me, can you come and meet with the stake president on Saturday? And I went, sure. When? And he went, well, what time is convenient to you? Great. Okay. So I arranged a time and the whole way up in the car, we just had a baby. Our first son was 3 months old. And the whole way up in the car, I was thinking, well, they wouldn't dare call me as the bishop now.
Did you know that the bishop was being released?
Nope.
That? Oh, okay.
No.
So there was no sign.
The bishop himself didn't know he was being released.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So I was summoned, and we would spent the entire time, you know, with a 3-month-old in the back of the car. It's about an hour and a half drive from our house to the stake center. So we spent about an hour and a half in the car thinking, well, you know, it could be high council, stake young men's. It could be anything, really.
Yeah, we've all played this game on the way to the stake center.
And, but I've been told, you know, when you get called as a bishop, you get asked an additional question, which is, are you free from unmanageable debt? Mm-hmm. Which was what I was asked. And the state president just took me to one side and said, you know, are you worthy of a temple recommend? Yes. Are you free from unmanageable debt? Yes. Okay, let's go into the other room and we'll have a chat with you and your wife. And that's when the call came. He just came straight out with it, saying, you know, there's no easy way to do this, but
here it is.
Here it is.
Nice.
And then he asked me to pray about counselors. And then a couple of weeks later, I was sustained in the ward just before Christmas.
Nice. And you talk about, you know, the previous bishop, you had a lot of respect for him and he was a mentor to you. Is he still in the ward?
He's still in the ward, yes. Yeah.
So what was that dynamic like of somebody you respected and now you are his bishop?
Well, I couldn't stop calling him bishop for about a year.
Right.
It was weird. And he's a fantastic example of just reaching out to people and looking after them. And it was one I kind of still feel to this day I can't measure up to because I just can't always make the time to do it. And he's, you know, he was a good example to me, a good mentor to me about how you can put aside certain aspects of the administration of a ward and concentrate on the ministering in the ward, which is looking after other people. Yeah. And he was fantastic at doing that.
Nice.
And he still is.
Right, right. And what does he do now in the ward? Or what are some things that you put him to work as?
Oh, he's served pretty much everywhere now, I think. You know, he's actually, when he was still the bishop, he had a heart bypass surgery.
Oh, wow.
So he had to guide him through that. And then he continued to serve as the bishop. And, you know, he's just always put himself out there helping people. And, you know, he still does that to this day. He just, you know, he doesn't feel he needs to wait for an assignment. If he sees a need, he'll fulfill it. And that's brilliant for someone like me.
Yeah, for sure. That definitely helps. Goes a long way. Now, obviously, as I do in these How I Lead interviews, I've had you think about a few leadership principles that we'll talk about. But just, and you've talked about the church generally there, but how would you describe the demographics, the characteristics of your ward?
My ward is generally older. The area in which I live doesn't, you know, generally people, when they're younger, move away to a bigger city or, you know, to get an education and don't always come back. So kind of the ward is mainly made up of the parents of people my age. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually one of the younger members of the ward. We have some young men, some young women, not many. We have a lot of members that are 50 plus and a few younger families such as my own, but not many. So, you know, it is an older ward, I would say, but you know, even the oldest members are kind of who are real pioneers in the church, and they were members of the ward when it wasn't a ward. It was, you know, not even a branch. It was just a couple of people meeting above a shop.
Yeah.
But they still have kind of the vigor to serve, which is great.
That's awesome. And now that you know, we don't call it home or visiting teaching anymore, but how would you describe the ministering effort of your ward? Has that been, are there long distances? Is it something that is, I don't want to say easy to do, but something that's been consistent, or how would you describe that?
We are not bad.
Okay.
the you know, it's I'm very grateful for the change that's come from home visiting teaching, that we don't have to report, you know, a monthly visit in the home where you share a message from the Ensign. And I think that's great, because what my ward is very good at is just looking after people, which up until now you never really reported.
Right.
You know, we would discuss about things that were going on, but everybody is, because we're relatively small, a lot of people have known each other all their lives. They just look after each other, and they don't have to wait for a piece of paper to say, you are assigned to look after this person. They just do it. And so kind of taking the time to minister one to another, and, you know, one by one, and everybody has different needs at different times in their lives, I think is great that they can just reach out and look after each other. And it makes my life easy, because then I am hopefully most of the time made aware of something that might be going on that I need to intervene in
and
deal with.
How would you describe your approach to the many meetings you have, your appointments as a bishop, any unique, whether it's technology you use or approach that you have with those?
Well, I try to keep meetings to a minimum. I think there are certain people in every ward council that just love meetings. They just love to turn up and they love to talk. And they will come to me saying, you know, we need to have more meetings. And I said, well, what are we going to discuss? Uh-huh. So you give me an agenda, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
So I will only ever have a ward council meeting and bishopric meetings when it's required, when we have something to discuss. My bishopric, my councillors on my bishopric, one of them sometimes works away, one of them works away every week. And so we are distant from each other physically, but we have a group text that we have. We use the Signal app.
Signal app? Yeah. Oh, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, it's an end-to-end encryption, you know, text messaging app that we just use to talk day-to-day about things that are going on. You know, I'm 5,000 miles away from them at the moment, but we've still been having chats with each other about things that are going on. Obviously, we're just at the end of General Conference here and talking about that. And when we have a meeting, you know, we'll video conferencing if we need to. And, you know, so I normally have one counselor there and the other one on a FaceTime or something. Nice. Just propped up.
So the Signal app, is it? So it's an app you download on your phone and then
an iPhone app, and it's just a fun little app to have chats with. So I got my little bishopric group here. And
nice. I love that. And you talk about, you know, really minimizing meetings. Mm-hmm. Is that so? When you do have a ward council, ward council members submit different agenda topics and you get to a point thinking, okay, we should probably meet and talk about this.
So I said, you know, we try to set a certain time for ward council meetings every month. And normally we'd meet very briefly after church as a ward council, just discuss anything very pressing.
So at least once a month, you have a set time.
Once a month, we will have a set time to
maybe a 5-minute meeting, could be a 10-minute or more. I imagine it goes
In terms of every week we'll get together a couple of minutes just to talk about anything that we need to do, and then we'll have a set. I try to no more than an hour sit down, really discuss the matters of the war that we need to discuss at the war council. And I try to encourage all the members of the war council, please contact my executive secretary beforehand saying what you would like to discuss, how long do you think you would need, so we're not surprised at the meeting. You know, everybody's tired by a certain point and wants to get home. And then someone, well, I want to talk about this very important thing, which really we should have talked about at the beginning.
Yeah. Nice. Any other ward traditions or efforts or things that are unique to your ward or your stake that would be worth mentioning, or
anything particularly unique? No. I mean, we live on the beach, so as much as we can, we try to get there. And, nice. Be a part of the efforts. My ward is great. We work with the local women's shelter and men's shelter. We collect items for them and work with them. We work with a local homeless charity as well in providing items that they might need, and especially at Christmas. And we also have a food bank in our community, which we are a major donator of food for. Huh. So for a little ward, I think we do quite a lot.
Nice.
And in the stake, in the ward where the stake center is, they have a soup run every couple of weeks, actually, where they will go out in the city of Plymouth and take food and soup and blankets to homeless people within the city.
Oh, wow. That's great.
A great effort.
And so do you organize certain assignments? The Elders Quorum has 10, needs to provide 10 people to go do that, or how does that?
Well, I don't know how they particularly do it in their ward. I think a lot of the work that we do with the homeless charity in our ward and the shelter is primarily driven by the Relief Society.
Oh, okay.
And they tell us what they need from us, and I'm happy to provide that.
You make it happen. Yeah. Cool. Well, let's jump into some of your leadership principles you put down here. The first one is, I think I like this one, that it's important to keep a sense of humor.
Oh, yes. I think that's why I created the Twitter, to be honest.
Right.
I needed to get certain jokes out that I can't always make from the pulpit. You have to, when you're in any leadership calling in the church, sometimes you have to deal with incredibly difficult, sometimes heartbreaking life or death situations that can be very, very, very hard to deal with. So I think it's important at times when you're not dealing with the very heartbreaking situations that you can just keep a sense of humor about you. And, you know, so we'll have a bishopric meeting, we'll have a laugh and a joke and, you know, talk about things that are going on. And it's just to keep it's a little bit lighter, that we're not just kind of droning on about church business and just leaving it at that. We need to be friends with each other. We've got to share a laugh and a joke. And so I think a sense of humor is very important. I think a sense of humor is my coping mechanism to just get through the day. I think it's, you know, social awkwardness that I'll just crack a joke to get around a difficult situation.
Nice. So is there anything like, is it just a matter of just having a humorous attitude about some things, or in some meetings, saying things here and there? Or do you have an intentional approach to that, or a routine or
I don't. I just try not to get pressed by everything that's going on.
Get too caught up in it.
Get too caught up in it. And you do get caught up. You can't help it. There are, you know, there are just days you come home from the calling exhausted and just want to cry and wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning worried.
Yeah.
But as long as you kind of have something in your life still going that can make you laugh and smile, and you can still look at certain areas of the work and have a cheerful attitude about it, I think that makes it easier to cope. Because I think, especially as a bishop, and I've seen it in other bishops as well, you can just get worn down and wear out very, very quickly if you just get sucked into the worrying situations.
Yeah. So I'm sure this has played into your longevity as a 9-year bishop, right?
I'm a slow learner, or I have something still I need to know. I'm not quite sure, but I think for me, I'm still enjoying it.
Yeah,
I still enjoy serving as the bishop. I would say 51% of the work I enjoy, and the 49% is really not enjoyable, but it's just that little bit more enjoyable than awful.
Right.
And that's what keeps you going.
Yeah. And humor has played a part in that.
Keep
everybody laughing and enjoying.
Yeah, just have a smile on your face and, you know.
That's cool. The next principle we put is have skin as thick as a rhino.
Yes.
Is there a few stories behind that one?
Well, I was given that advice by, when I was first called as a bishop, I was wise, and I called two former bishops as my counselors because, you know, I was still kind of young and naive, so I needed to have their experience. And they said there were going to be people that are going to hate you. No matter what you do, they're just not going to like you. And they might say mean things about you or do mean things to you. And you just have to kind of let those things just ricochet off you. Just have a thick skin and just get on with the work. And, you know, I was told once that when you're called as a bishop, 20% of the ward will probably think you're the best thing in the world. You know, they will think, oh, this is my favorite bishop. This guy is brilliant. Yeah. But then you'll get another 20% to think, what's this guy doing here for, you know, and not like you and never want to interact with you. And then kind of you have the 60% in the middle that will just get on with the work no matter what. And they don't really mind or care who's in the calling. And that's the people you have to really concentrate on and work with, those that don't mind sustain you either way, but are willing to work with you.
Yeah.
You know, it can be upsetting because obviously, especially now in the age of, you know, people are constantly in contact with each other. If I've upset somebody inadvertently, then a group of other people will know about that very, very quickly. Right. And, you know, I've become aware in the years, especially after 9 years, of things that have been said about me on Facebook or something that are quite hurtful. And if I really took that to heart, I'd be very, very upset. But you just have to let that roll off and, you know, if I've made a mistake, try and rectify it and go from there. But, you know, it's easy to be upset. You know, I don't know how other church leaders cope because there's things said about them all the time that are quite hurtful, and you just got to ignore it.
Yeah. And sometimes it's difficult, right? And obviously after 9 years, it gets easier, but sometimes it could be even 5 to 10% of the ward that just really has a problem with some decisions you made. And sometimes that takes all your focus because you want everybody to enjoy their association with their bishop, but
I think if everybody just thought you were brilliant, you probably weren't doing the job right.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there are always going to be there's always going to be somebody that doesn't agree with the decision you've made. No, you know, there are plenty of people that don't agree with the decision you made, but keep quiet about it and will go along with it anyway. Right. But there's going to be it's tiny. In my ward, it's brilliant because it's a very, very tiny minority that will just, no matter what decision I make, won't like it. Well,
it is what it is, and you move on just try and make progress. Because I think it is a sign of if everybody likes you, that's a sign of poor leadership in some degree. And who knows where it's at, but it's maybe a time to reevaluate and say, why does everybody like me?
Yeah, I think it's great to apologize when you see you might have made a mistake or say sorry, but you've got to move on beyond that.
Nice. The third principle you put down is don't procrastinate. It's human nature, right?
Well, it is, yeah. And it's sometimes you have a situation you have to deal with. Mm. Something that you can't delegate it, and it's going to be unpleasant. You know it's going to be unpleasant, so you might as well act now.
Yeah.
Rather than just try and put it off, because in my experience, the longer you put off a problem, the bigger the problem actually ends up becoming.
Right.
And I think I made that mistake in my early days. You know, I kind of felt that there were certain situations that were sensitive, but I didn't want to deal with them instantly. I thought, I'll wait, see how this plays out, and realize now that if I had helped earlier and thought about it earlier, that it would have been better in the long term.
Yes, I think it's so easy to just assume. Sometimes some problems come up and you think, well, maybe it'll just go away, right?
Yes.
And there's this passive aggressive struggle, or mm-hmm. you know, nobody's really talking about it. There's an elephant in the room, but you just sort of hope maybe in a few months everybody will forget about this.
And I think also it's important to recognize the things that you have to deal with and those that you can just put to one side. Yeah. And it's that discernment, because there's also a lot of nonsense you have to deal with day to day. You know, I someone will complain about how the chairs have been laid out in the priesthood room or something and be upset about that. And well, that's not really my problem.
You have bigger fish to fry here.
And have to kind of put nonsense to one side in terms of, church governance, and deal with the situations you have to deal with, which is, sometimes it's life and death. It's terrifying, but I've got to be there and deal with it.
Yeah. Anything else with as far as avoiding procrastination that we haven't said?
Well, and I suppose it's just acting on promptings. And that's the thing, sometimes I feel prompted to act, and it's, especially, late in the evening, you just want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're like, no, I've got to at least make this phone call or talk to this person or go and visit somebody else. And that takes a little bit of effort sometimes, because it's, I think, the natural man in me just wants to go to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the bishop in me can't.
Right. That's great. The fourth one he says is listen more than you speak.
Yeah. There are some people in church leadership that just like to talk at you. I was in a meeting with, I think it was Elder Bednar, a leadership meeting once, where he talked about the way that we seem to like to deal with people in the church is talk at them. If you have a less active member that you want to reach out to, you go to their house and you talk at them, and then you invite them to church so you can talk at them some more. And I don't like that. I like to listen to people.
Yeah.
So if I'm ever in an interview situation, I want to hear what they have to say and only speak a little bit at the end. And especially, when you have people in your office that are crying and have a difficult situation in their lives, the easiest, I think sometimes the natural instinct is to want to get this interview over quickly. So to say something to end it. But no, I need to take the time to really listen, to think. And all of that time, I'm kind of praying in my head about what my response might be. And my response might be nothing.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And I just need to listen rather than give my opinion on absolutely every aspect of their lives. I think sometimes the best way of enabling people to deal with problems in their life is just allowing them to vocalize those problems, and they sort it out for themselves. Yeah. So I'm just kind of a conduit to that rather than the oracle of all answers.
Yeah.
Which I think people... Right. tend to think bishops sometimes are, that they will have all of the answers instantly.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting. I remember some instances, somebody leaving the bishop's office just so grateful that, thank you for bishop for all that you've done. This has been such a helpful meeting. And I'm thinking, I didn't really say anything. You just needed like a sounding board. You just needed to talk through these things with somebody listening.
Yeah. I think it's great. I think the most enjoyable aspect of the calling is just seeing somebody use the processes that the gospel of Jesus Christ allows them. So using that repentance process and using the gift of the atonement of our Savior to make tweaks in their lives, to make their lives just that little bit easier. And I really myself do nothing. I kind of just help kind of steer them in the right direction, and then they use their agency to make the right choices in their lives. And I think that's the most fulfilling aspect of church leadership, is just seeing a change for the better in people.
Yeah, I love that. And this soul, I love the way you articulate that sometimes we just talk at people, right? And I think especially when you're in a bishopric meeting, I remember several stake presidency meetings where, okay, there's this problem, what can we do? And we sort of, the default position is, well, let's hold a meeting and we're going to call these three speakers to stand up and talk to them. And maybe that'll change it. But there's such this power in sitting down with somebody, even one-to-one, and just saying, you know, what's your perspective? Mm-hmm. How do you see this? You know, why aren't you doing your ministry visits? Or, you know, what can we change? What do you think? You know, and that goes a long way.
I think a lot of the people it seems to be in the church, our default mode is let's do something sociable with a bunch of people talking. Yeah. And for a lot of people, I would probably include myself in that that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
I much prefer to be in a smaller group, just more chilled out, rather than this having to force myself to be sociable. And I think we need to recognize that for a lot of people. But our default mode is, well, we have this problem, let's have this activity or this meeting and have all of these people talk.
Yeah.
And
there's better ways.
There are far better ways to reach out to people rather than talking at them a bunch.
Yeah, love that. The last principle you put, I think we've hit them all here. Let people serve, and how do you put it? And forgive them when they mess up or something like that?
Yes, I think it's very easy when you see areas of wards or whatever unit you might have responsibility for where things could be better. And I think especially in my early days, was like, well, this needs to be done. I'll go and do it. Mm-hmm. But you have people called, you have elders, quorum presidents, you have relief society presidents, you have young women leaders, primary leaders, all of whom have been called and set apart with priesthood authority to act in that particular office. So let them do it. Mm-hmm. And then if something goes wrong and they fail, well, still love them. Be kind.
Yeah.
You know, it's be kind and gentle. And that's kind of difficult sometimes when you just want to intervene and just do their calling for them.
Yeah.
But what's the point? There would be no point in calling Relief Society presidents and Elders of Quorum presidents if you're just going to pick up the slack and do it for them.
Right.
There's no point. So it's just allowing them to have the ability to learn and serve themselves. And we all fail in all of our callings at certain times within it.
Yeah.
And you just need someone loving to help them after something bad might have happened. And I've been very lucky. I've always surrounded myself with very people far clever, more clever than I am, and far more diligent in their service than I am. So I've never really had to deal with that so much. But it's just being able to let go of areas where I shouldn't be interfering and letting them have the inspiration for themselves for the area of responsibility that they might have.
Yeah. So how does that look like day to day? I mean, what's an example of that? Because I think on paper, every leader wants to do that. But then I hear, you know, different stories, and I think that leader, I don't think understands that principle, but what in your leadership, what does that look like day to day or week to week?
Well, obviously I have members of my board that are probably going to listen to this, so I can't give examples.
Okay,
in general, how do I put this? In general, say, a good example would be once a quarter, we have to submit a quarterly report. And up until recently, you had to gather home and visiting teaching numbers, which I am overjoyed we don't have to do that anymore. Right. We just had to, you know, now report meetings with companionships, but that was always a chore, getting all of these numbers and reports in on time. And my thing would be just to kind of, well, jump in and gather them myself because I can get it done quicker. Well, no, because that's a waste of my time. That's not a good use of my time. There are other people that have been called to do that, and let's just wait for them to do it. And, you know, there's, you know, making sure that waiting for now, you know, ministering companionships to go out and see people rather than just, well, I'm going to wade in and do that myself. You don't have to have the bishop deal with every aspect of your life.
Right. And so how does that look like as far as how you manage callings? Because one thing I see that just diminishes, you know, auxiliary leaders, especially I see it in primary, where the bishopric determines, you know, every teacher that's going to serve there, you know, they're being very, where the primary president isn't even talking about calling, they just know the bishop is going to put them in or call this person. And some of these poor primary presidents find out in sacrament meeting who their new teacher or counselor is. So how do you manage callings by still giving them that autonomy?
Well, I don't do that. My primary president needs a teacher called. I ask her to go away and pray about who you would like and then come back to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, as far as primary young women are concerned, I've never imposed anybody on it.
Yeah,
I wait for them to feel the inspiration because they deal closer with the children in primary or young women, young men's, than I would deal with day to day. So they would probably be more receptive to inspiration about who would be the best people to teach them than I would be. So let them have the inspiration.
Awesome. You passed the test. That's good. That's good. And any, if the primary president comes to you and wants to call the first counselor in the young women's presidency, I mean, with that, how do you handle that?
Well, if I can see her inspiration behind it, I go with it. And that's the thing, because as far as I'm concerned, actually, a counselor in our state presidency sometimes likes to bring up some controversial statements just to see how people react. And he said, he once said that I think what we should do is everybody over the age of 50, you're on your own. That's it. You know, you can, you've been here long enough. You work for yourselves now. We're not going to look after you anymore unless you really, really need it. Where our focus is on the young members of the ward. So I need to make sure that young women's in primary have the best teachers than Relief Society does most of the time, because they're more seasoned within Relief Society. So they can pick up some more areas of slack than young women in primary, which is formative years in the church. Unless you have your best people there, then you're not going to do so well. I like to graph it. You know, you can actually, in primary, pure doctrine is taught, and that slowly diminishes as you become, you know, and opinion increases as the older you get in church until you get become a high priest, and it's mostly opinion. And
that's so true. It's another funny part of our culture, right? It's
yes.
Can we just get back to the basics, people? Come on. Well, it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic with the elders' quorum.
Well, I think I'm very excited about that. I mean, I am expecting maybe a few people throughout the church, you know, who will then miss just having their old buddies in a smaller meeting. But I think having a range of experience, a range of backgrounds in the mix is far better than just a few people who just think the same.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And that takes me, one other point I wanted to hit with you before we stop recording is, you know, as I've looked at your tweets, obviously you come from a different culture. I mean, it's still Western perspective, but you know, in the church, one thing that living in Utah, I think you see it more than any place because there's such a high density of Mormons. And so when I go to my ward, everybody has pretty much the same opinion, whether it's a political opinion, whether it's a doctrinal opinion. And so, which is fine, I guess, but what that does is I think we miss a richer, deeper discussion in some of our council meetings because we don't have different perspectives to consider. Mm-hmm. We just assume, well, everybody agrees with this, so therefore it must be doctrinal. And therefore, anybody who doesn't, it builds this us and them mentality.
It does. Yeah.
And I don't know if you would label yourself as a progressive Mormon or that type of thing, but I just feel like I appreciate a lot of your tweets because it gives me pause at times to think, how does that fit in? You know, and you know, rarely do I necessarily disagree with the tweets, but I appreciate the variety of perspective that maybe just being raised in a different country brings to that. And so what would you say to a group of leaders as far as being open to different opinion and bridging the gap between conservative and progressive Mormons a little bit better so that we can, it's less of an us and them mentality.
Well, I think that's the problem, is that you're categorizing people.
Right.
I wouldn't categorize myself as I guess I am a progressive Mormon, but I wouldn't like to be lumped in that category because why? Why do I have to be? Because I think the gospel of Jesus Christ, the culture of the gospel transcends any culture we can possibly have in the church itself. And so, you know, in my ward, we have, in terms of political views, ranging from communist full through to full right wing, you know, and it's, we have a good mix within the middle of that, but it doesn't come up in church because we all know that these are topics we just don't touch because the gospel transcends all of that. And the nature of Christ transcends that. And it can be very, very, very difficult, I think, especially if you've only ever grown up in one culture and only dealt with one type of people to think outside of your area of safety.
Right.
And it can be, I think, sometimes we allow our own cultural prejudices and our own way of looking at the world to color the gospel of Jesus Christ when it really should not. Because what we're doing is we are putting a mask over the church that shouldn't exist. We are kind of putting a layer of culture on there that holds people back from really embracing the gospel because they have to wade through cultural tradition before they can get there. And that can be very, very, very difficult for people to overcome. And I think, you know, the pace of change in the church comes relatively slowly. At least it did until, you know, General Conference weekend when an awful lot happened very quickly. Yeah. But people can be sometimes resistant to change and new ways of looking at things. And I suppose because I'm a convert to the church, I guess I'm relatively socially liberal. that I see things with a different perspective, and I'm very much more of a fan of, well, you know, come and join in and let's have differing opinions and different views. But ultimately, as long as we're all agreeing that Jesus Christ is who he says he is and can help you in your life, then don't worry about anything else.
Yeah.
You know, that's, if you have that opinion that's holding somebody back from realizing that, get rid of that opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in your ward, you mentioned you sort of have a variety of perspectives in that, right? That, mm-hmm. Does that come out in the council meetings or in the discussions and lessons in Sunday school where people say, well, I sort of see it this way and I see it that way. And does it come out that way, or do people set that aside and just focus on the basic tenets of the gospel?
Well, I've been 9 years trying to stop it, but it does come out occasionally. Okay. You know, it just is what happens.
Yeah.
Sadly, people will come out with their opinion. And I think generally the longer you've been around and the more comfortable you feel,
yeah,
the more likely it is that your opinion is going to come out.
Yeah.
And sometimes those opinions run counter, I believe, to the gospel.
Yeah.
And so I think it's what you need is brave people to be able to call those out in a kind way.
Yeah.
To be able to say, well, actually, that's not the way it is.
Yeah.
And we can back that up with scriptures and words from the brethren.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much a fan of a loving embrace of everybody rather than excluding people just because they might think differently.
Yeah. And I guess my fear is that if leaders hear or think that I need to stop this from happening, then different opinions or perspectives aren't brought up. And then everybody assumes everybody thinks the same,
mm-hmm.
right? Where I think there's a rich experience if someone, again, not that we straight up, you know, put political opinions and tenets on the board and mm-hmm. break them down, but just, you know, for someone to raise their hand in Sunday school and say, you know what, I've often struggled with women not having the priesthood. Mm-hmm. And I sort of wish that that was maybe something that would happen.
I do wish that we could vocalize concerns such as that,
yeah,
better rather than just shutting down a conversation.
Yeah.
But having a proper answer, because everybody goes through different experiences in life. But the whole purpose, if the church really is what it claims to be, it is universal for everybody. So if we're preventing somebody from embracing the gospel, then we need to kind of maybe push away certain aspects of culture, yeah, that would make that happen. And so I just want to create a culture where people can feel that they are loved, and that their concerns will be listened to rather than dismissed,
right,
or just talked over.
Yeah.
Mansplained.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Yeah. I think that's a deep discussion, and one that I hope to, with future episodes, venture into a little bit more, because I just feel like, especially, and maybe I see it on a higher scale in Utah, where we all have very similar backgrounds. You know, a lot of us have pioneer heritage, mm-hmm. in the church. And so the tradition sometimes and culture is easily melted into the doctrine.
Oh, certainly, yes.
Right? And we can't tell them apart.
And I've experienced a church in both places. You know,
yeah.
I joined the church here and then moved back to the UK. And I've experienced, you know, and it's very much the case, and this is a bit of a sweeping generalization, but where I live now, people go to church because they genuinely want to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sacrifice that comes with that. There's a social sacrifice that comes with that. It's a sacrifice of time. But they come to church because they really want to. I have members of the church that would drag themselves over hot coals just,
yeah,
to be, yeah, there and experience that. Whereas I suppose in areas where the church is far more established, it's just easier to turn up because that's the culture. You know, you do it and your dad did it and his father did it and his father was Brigham Young. So that's just the way it's always been.
Right. Yeah. This happens a lot in Utah where, you know, not only is there this cultural stigma of attending church, but you also have to go into the office Monday morning and people are going to say, hey, what did you think about the Sunday school lesson?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or did you go to church, or how was your church? And mm-hmm. if you said, oh, well, I just didn't go, there's going to have to be some reason why, or had a sick kid or whatever it is, right? And so that culture transcends to the work culture,
mm-hmm.
you know, because a lot of your coworkers are LDS.
Well, it's everywhere. It's
yeah.
It's unavoidable.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if you wanted to, you could go to work where I live and never ever talk about the
right.
church.
Yeah, not even let people know you're,
yeah,
a Mormon. Right?
And it's completely the opposite. You will not be asked about what your, yeah, experience was at church because nobody else went.
Yeah. Well, anyways, just a topic. I appreciate you commenting on it. And those listening, hopefully, I want to connect with the right people because that could maybe talk this out, because I think there's such a need for diversity of thought in our local wards and units, just so that we can gain a deeper understanding and a deeper belief, mm-hmm. of our own, by seeing, okay, he lives as a Mormon a different way than I do. Mm-hmm. And that's okay because we're both seeking towards the same goal, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. We ought to enjoy the journey together rather than saying, well, you're on that bus over there and yeah. I don't want to be a part of you. Exactly. You know, I think exactly. I just love the embracing universal aspects of the church. And I just try to push back on areas that might seek to divide people and want to exclude people just because of their background, beliefs, anything to do with that. And, yeah. you know, it's easier, I think. I mean, I think I'm very lucky living in an area where the church is relatively small because it's easier, I think, to put those things aside.
Yeah.
Because it really is more of an aspect of survival and we really are in it together.
Awesome. Well, good discussion. Ross, this has been fantastic. I appreciate you flying all the way over here.
Just for this interview.
Yes. luckily, you have family in town and you can visit them as well. But last question I always ask is, as you look back on your 9 years as serving as bishop and being the leader, how has it made you a better follower or disciple of Jesus Christ?
I think it's certainly made me recognize his role in all of this. I'm just kind of a facilitator to bringing his gospel to other people. I just help people understand everything that he's ever done, you know, for them. I certainly understand more how universal the atonement of Jesus Christ is, because I might go through experiences in my life that I recognize that I can adjust by using the gift of the atonement of Jesus Christ in my life to help make adjustments and make me overcome whatever difficulties I have. But other people's difficulties are completely different to mine sometimes. And we all go through our own personal trials, but the Savior has suffered equally for all of those. And recognizing that just makes me understand how Christ looks at people. And he looks at them all the same and just wants them to be with him. And he has suffered for us and he's been through all of our pains and weaknesses and trials in life. And he's suffered through them all equally. So we need to see people as Christ sees them, because he's been through the full range of human emotion and experience, of which we as individuals will only experience a tiny portion of. But he's been through everything. So we need to recognize that when you look at somebody who claims they're going through a trial and we don't recognize that as a trial, that's trivial and insignificant. Well, guess what? It's a trial for them, and that's how Christ sees it. And so we need to deal with people the way he would.
That concludes my interview with Ross Truella. Fantastic, fun time to talk with him. And I just love the accent. You know, we need more accents. Like we have many accents in General Conference, we need more accents on the Leading LDS podcast. And it was fun to include Ross in this. I learned a lot from him, and what an inspiring conversion story. And it's cool to see those that are converted to the gospel and then thrown into leadership right after. A fantastic way, obviously, through our service that we can grow and develop our testimony in the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. If there's anybody else in the Twitter stake that is willing to step up to the plate like Ross and share their leadership opinion, I'd love to connect with you and see if we can arrange that, especially you, stake clerk. He's a good follow as well. Or if you know anybody else that would add a beneficial voice on the Leading LDS podcast to talk about how they lead in their calling, whatever it is, especially you ladies out there, we are always looking for more and more sisters to get on the Leading LDS podcast and share your experience of how you lead in the church. And don't forget, visit leadinglds.org/teach to check out the 3 most viewed sessions from the recent Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. When the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.